Welcome to the Plant School Podcast. I'm Rachel, and here we learn about plants, how to care for them, how they work, and I keep it simple and taught in a way that anyone from beginner to expert can enjoy. Join me in Plant School. Welcome to Plant School on this beautiful day. Well, here it's not very beautiful unless, you know, I guess rainy days could be beautiful. It's very rainy here today. I think it's pretty. It smells good. I think I'm just excited because it's starting to feel like fall. And I pulled out my apple spice candle and me and my two little boys went and picked apples from our backyard, from our neighbor's tree. And I am just so excited for cooler weather. So I hope that your day is beautiful in some way as well. So today's episode, you can see that it's a Men in Botany episode. I started the Women in Botany series and then quickly realized, you know what? I can't leave men out. There's so many great scientists and botanists out there. I want to highlight both sides. Both are equally as amazing. And this man that we're covering today, David Fairchild, I'm telling you, he blew me away. It was so much fun to learn about him. Sometimes learning about a botanist can feel a little monotonous. Wow, look at me go with my rhyming here. But David Fairchild is not a monotonous botanist. He is something else. He's just the way he's changed our lives, and you'll see how he's changed your life, is incredible to me. So I'm so excited for this episode and for you to hear and learn about who David Fairchild is. To start off, I just want to give you a brief overview of who he is and kind of what he encapsulates. He's an American botanist and plant explorer, and he's responsible for the introduction of more than 80,000 exotic plants and has transformed what we eat. And if you're wondering how he did that, we are definitely going to be learning about that, and it is, like I said, just so interesting. So starting with David's early life, he was born on April 7th in 1869 in Lansing, Michigan, and he was raised in Manhattan, Kansas. He graduated from Kansas State College of Agriculture in 1888, largely because this is where his father, George Fairchild, was president of the school. He then went on to Iowa State and also Rutgers, where his uncle was. His uncle, his name is Byron Halstead, he was a notable biologist and perhaps influenced David's career, but honestly, David had grown up around intellectuals. His mom had gone to school and got a higher education, which wasn't super common in the mid-1800s. His dad, of course, you know, was the president at Kansas State College, and so they were heavily involved in the school and were constantly around professors and people who really loved the natural world. And so I think that also kind of influenced David Fairchild and him wanting to go into botany. Okay, so let's get into his career. So his career started when he went to Naples, Italy on a grant from the Smithsonian to find new edible and valuable plants to bring back to the U.S. And though this was his first trip, his career kind of really took off when he met this man who was very rich. His name was Thomas Barber Lathrop. And he was a very wealthy philanthropist, a world traveler, and he convinced David to join him in becoming a plant explorer for the United States Department of Agriculture. And Thomas underwrote many of these travels for him. So they were able to go really anywhere and everywhere because this was on Thomas's dime. And while they were out, really the whole purpose, like I said, was to be finding new plants to bring back to the U.S. And Thomas and David, they did this together for about 5 years, and then eventually the U.S. government stepped in and said that they could start covering David Fairchild's travels. There was no need for Thomas to be underwriting for him. They knew that this was an important thing, and so they had started the funding for it. But something really interesting of these early expeditions that he did, David Fairchild wrote in one of his books, and he said, "I am glad that I saw a few of the quiet places of the world before the coming of automobiles." What is that like? When I go up into the mountains, I so much enjoy the quiet that is there because there are no cars. There's not a whole lot of light pollution. It's just you and nature. And I can't imagine having like these travels around the world and automobiles just aren't there, and to see them come in and how it changes everything and changes the noise level, that would just be really interesting. Anyways, David Fairchild saw this and sounds like he enjoyed those quiet places. So in 1898, David Fairchild established a new branch of the U.S. government of agriculture. Brand new branch. It was called the Office of Seed and Plant Introduction. It was housed in Washington, D.C., and their starting initial budget was $20,000. Now, that doesn't really sound like a whole lot, but I went on to this inflation calculator, and $20,000 in 1898 is worth about $713,000 today. So it's a significant amount of money for these plant explorers to be working with to travel the world and be finding plants. And before David opened the Office of Seed and Plant Introduction, this new branch of the Department of Agriculture, it originally existed as just part of the responsibility of the commissioner of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And that fell on the shoulders of Isaac Newton. He was the first commissioner, and this was his responsibility in the beginning, was to travel around and bring in new plants. And not only bring them in, but also test their economic value and introduce them to American farmers. It was a huge job. You can see why they needed a new branch with more people taking this on of finding the plants, seeing how good they are back in the U.S., and then trying to incorporate them into an American farmer's life. So a lot of the people that were employed by the Office of Seed and Plant Introduction, they were plant scientists, plant pathologists. They weren't just some homie Joes that wanted to go out and travel the world and they kind of liked plants. They were scientists, and they were using that to be agricultural explorers. And so I mentioned they're traveling, and to bring them back and test them, they did have testing sites or gardens all over the U.S. And probably the most popular one included the USDA Plant Introduction Garden in Miami. I'm pretty sure it still exists and you can go see it. But they would test them, just make sure that they're not bringing any diseases, no insects. It's not going to take over some other crop and destroy our economy in any way. And this department overall, they are responsible for introducing over 200,000 species and varieties of non-native plants to the U.S. And that includes some of our most well-known crops. Because of this department, the industrialization of agriculture happened in the U.S., and it no longer really exists. There is a department that does collect and introduce new plant species, but the name has changed. So it's now called the National Germplasm Resources Laboratory. Honestly, not as exciting as the Office of Seed and Plant Introduction, in my opinion. But going back to David, he was appointed as the head of this department at its very inception, and he stayed involved in it for 27 years. He traveled to every single continent except Antarctica and over 50 countries. In those years, he and the people below him introduced over 80,000 plant species. That was just him working with his people. 80,000 plant species. That's amazing. He would send back seeds, saplings or cuttings, all sorts of plants to help them be introduced into the U.S. So let's move into what he actually brought here, because this is fascinating. And I'm going to start with one that I don't know if you can say takes the cake, because there are so many of them that are really important to us. But we'll start here. So the first one, he helped introduce the cherry tree from Japan into Washington. So we're just going to take a little pause and appreciate what a big deal this is. Because most of you listening probably know this, but Washington, D.C. has a hugely famous cherry blossom festival. And this can be related all back because David Fairchild brought this plant from Japan to the U.S. So he had cherry blossoms. He loved them. And there was kind of a stir going on of, we need to beautify Washington, D.C. It looks kind of ugly. And Helen Taft, who was the first lady at the time, she's usually credited with bugging her husband, the president of the United States, William Howard Taft, to bring in cherry trees. But this idea was really put into her mind by a woman named Eliza Skidmore and David Fairchild. They were both right there. I think Eliza was the one advocating first. We don't want to skip over her. But David Fairchild was a well-known scientist and was really able to push this idea for her as well. So William Taft, he agreed. He thought this idea was great, and it led to a chance to help with the diplomacy with the Japanese. So the Japanese sent over a huge batch of trees, and actually the first batch was infested with fungi and insects. The United States actually had to burn them all. I think it was like 200 trees or something like that. They had to burn them all. People were really worried that Japan was going to be ticked off at us for burning their gift, but they actually apologized. They totally understood, and they sent a second batch of trees that had, you know, no fungi, no disease. They didn't mean that first batch to have that. And this began the start of DC's famous Cherry Blossom Festival. And the very first one that was planted, the very first tree that was planted, David Fairchild was present at this cute little small ceremony to plant that first one. And from then on, it has just grown into something huge. So just to kind of paint you a picture of how big it is, these are some facts about the Cherry Blossom Festival. So the peak bloom, when people want to come and see it, all the trees are blooming, it's super beautiful, is usually around March 21st to the 25th. They actually have a whole forecast for the blooms, and they post updates on those wanting to see the peak bloom so you can kind of plan out your trip. It's at cherryblossomwatch.com, and that's the sole purpose of the website. And about 1.5 million people visit during this 4-week period that the festival is going on and all the blossoms are out. It generates about 100 to 160 million in economic activity for Washington, D.C. So it's a big deal. It's beautiful. I have not been, although I would love to go. And I think knowing about David Fairchild and his history and how he kind of helped introduce this plant just makes me want to see it more. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to share with you some of the other plants that David Fairchild introduced to the United States, and maybe some things you didn't expect. I don't know. We'll find out when we come back after this break. Oh my goodness, hello, it's me doing an ad for my own podcast. But I don't know if you guys know this, but this podcast, the Plant School Podcast, is put on by me, myself, and I. No one is paying me to do this. I do it in my free time, and I greatly appreciate any support that you can give to keep this podcast going. So there are three ways that you can support this podcast. Number one, you can share it with a friend. And if you do so, you actually enter into my giveaway. All you have to do is message me on Instagram at tinnyplants and let me know that you shared it, and I will enter you in to win some really cool Plant School merch for free. Secondly, you can buy Plant School merch all on your own. We have some really cool plant-related shirts and stickers, as well as Plant School podcast-specific shirts and stickers. The link to my merch store can be found in the show notes of every single episode. And third option that you can do to support this podcast is to become a supporter. There is a link at the very bottom of the details of every episode of my podcast, and you can click that link to support the podcast and set up a monthly donation. It can be as low as $1 a month, or it can be, you know, as high as you want. I won't tell you what to do. Any support that you can give is greatly appreciated. It allows me to spend my free time researching for you and helping you learn more about the plant world in a really fun and digestible way. I love doing this podcast, and I would really love your guys' help in sustaining it so that I can keep going with it for the long haul. Thank you. All right, I'm back and jumping right back into it of what David Fairchild introduced to America. So he brought back kale from Austria-Hungary. He brought back quinoa from Peru. He brought back dates from Iraq, avocados from Central America. He also brought back mangoes and nectarines, soybeans, pistachios, bamboo, horseradish, and so many others. Not everything was adopted into American agriculture, but those are some of the huge ones. So you may be listening to this list and wondering, well, what the heck was America even growing and eating before we had things like mangoes, nectarines, soybeans, avocados? What were we even eating? All that was usually grown by farmers before this was corn, oats, wheat. Those were the three huge ones. And if you can imagine, the country's agriculture really sagging, and agriculture was 60 to 70% of the labor force. So it was like the main industry and the engine of the United States. So we really needed something to change. Before this time, the United States went about a whole century with no claim to really any unique cuisine. We relied on meat, potatoes, and a cheese diet, very bland. And it wasn't until the 1870s that we started to shift away from this, try new seasonings. We started to understand nutrition more and had a desire to be trying new foods. And just to give you a glimpse into what this kind of looked like, the exotic banana, which bananas seem so normal to us now, but it was exotic then. The exotic banana was debuted at the 1876 World's Fair in Philadelphia. The banana was exotic in 1876. I don't know if I could survive eating back then, because I feel like bananas like aren't that crazy or flavorful. So you can see why it was so important for David Fairchild and his colleagues to be bringing back these new foods. One example of how he changed the game for the U.S. was in the Southwest United States, they weren't doing so great at producing cotton. It was a different environment, and the cotton that we had just didn't do great over there. So Fairchild, he looked at different Egyptian cultivars. He went to Egypt, and he brought one back that did great in the Southwestern U.S., and it was the main one that was used for years, and it grew great. It's known as Pima cotton, and I'm pretty sure it's still grown today in some areas. But on the flip side, and this is really interesting, he was bringing back these things, and sometimes it was not diplomatic and friendly. Most of the time it was, but other times David Fairchild's job was a little bit covert. He's been described as a food spy because of this reason, because he had to sneak things back to the U.S. because these countries did not want him taking back what they had. One example is that America wasn't really in the beer industry too much because we did not have good hops back in the day. And so if we didn't have good hops to rely on, that's the plant that makes beer. So you can see why our beer industry was lacking. So David did research, he traveled around, he found that Germany had the best hops and made the best beer, but they heavily guarded them. They didn't want anyone having their hops. They even had guards in their fields at night to keep anyone from taking them and stealing them. So what David did is he befriended some of these guards, he gained their trust, and they actually eventually let him take some back to the U.S. And it really helped balloon the hops industry in America. It started a whole beer industry in America that was able to take off. And it wasn't always like he would go find a plant, come back, and farmers were just so gung-ho. It was really difficult to convince farmers to try these new crops and take risks on them and create a whole new market for them. So getting items kind of, I guess, infused with American agriculture and the American diet was extremely difficult. Actually, one of Fairchild's favorite fruits is one that did not make it into mainstream American culture. So it's called a mangosteen. It's unrelated to the mango, but it's about the size of your fist. It's purple, and on the inside, there's this white flesh. It almost looks similar to an orange, how there's like slivers of an orange, right? That's kind of how it pulls apart. It's a little bit slimy, but it's really sweet and really tasty. So you pull off the purple rind, you eat that white fleshy middle part, and this was David Fairchild's favorite fruit. He called it the queen of fruits, and alas, it did not make it into our mainstream diet or anything. I looked it up of like, how can I try one of these? and you can have them shipped over. They probably aren't as good as they would be in their native countries where you can just be picking them. I'm not sure if you're able to grow them here. I feel like I saw some articles about how it was illegal, but I did see that you can find them at some Sprouts markets. So if you want to try a mangosteen, the queen of fruits, according to David Fairchild, you could try out your local Sprouts, maybe call them and see if they have them. I really want to try one now because they sound yummy. They look pretty good too. But I do have to say, I am so grateful for the foods that he did bring over. My husband especially, he loves mangoes. He spent 2 years in Brazil. They have a lot of mangoes over there. And so having them here in the US, I need to let him know that he can be thankful to David Fairchild for that. But just so many foods that we take for granted, like all you crunchy people have kale and quinoa now, and soybeans, those are like staples. Oh, and avocados, those are like staples of a crunchy person's diet, right? And right now I've been loving nectarines. It's kind of been a pregnancy craving. So again, David Fairchild, thank you for changing the American diet and bringing these wonderful foods over for us to enjoy. I never even thought about how they got here, but now we know it was thanks to this man. Putting aside his botanical endeavors and kind of going into his life, in 1905, he married Marion Bell, who's one of the younger daughters of Alexander Graham Bell, the man who literally invented the telephone. And in 1926, the Fairchild family built a home on an 8-acre parcel in Coconut Grove, Florida. They named it the Kampong, and they named it this after these family compounds that are found in Java, Indonesia, where David had spent a lot of his time collecting plants on his expeditions. And so he took inspiration from that and named this little 8-acre family compound the Kampong. And they had two kids. Their oldest was Alexander Graham Bell Fairchild, and he went on to become an entomologist. Those are people who study bugs. And Nancy Bell, their daughter, she is an author herself, and she actually married an entomologist. So their two kids were heavily involved with bugs, it seems, which is really cool. You can see that the love for the sciences passed down to their children. Throughout his life, David wrote 4 books and 1 with his wife, so a total of 5 books. The first one was with his wife. It was called The Book of Monsters. And it sounds like a children's book or something, but it's actually not, though this book revolves around them taking macro photography of bugs and just like really close-up pictures of bugs. And yeah, I can see why you'd call it Book of Monsters, because bugs close up are really, really kind of scary to look at. And then he also wrote books, you know, about his life. His first one was called Exploring for Plants, kind of details his adventures being a plant explorer. Next one was called The World Was My Garden. And again, it's kind of a continuation of his exploration and bringing it back to the US. He also wrote Garden Island of the Great East. And his last book he wrote was The World Grows Round My Door, The Story of the Kampong. And so that one details his home and how he had all these exotic plants growing around his home. I have to say, his books intrigued me. I wanted to read them, but it's not something you normally find at like a local library. So I actually made a donation to the university I attended. We still live close to it. And so I went to their library, made a donation so that I would be allowed to check out books. And you bet your bum that I got all of David Fairchild's book on loan to kind of look through them and read. And if you're interested, I feel like his books, they're older, right? These are written in the 1930s, 1940s. So I feel like most people would probably not be interested, but there is a newer book written about him that is really intriguing. So the full name of the book is The Food Explorer, The True Adventures of the Globe-Trotting Botanist Who Transformed What America Eats. I don't know about you, but if you do want to learn more about David and all the exciting adventures he had, you can look into The Food Explorer by Daniel Stone. But moving on, I want to highlight some of the awards this man received, some of the memberships he had. He was a member of the Board of Trustees for the National Geographic Society. He was a member of the Board of Regents at the University of Miami from 1929 to 1933. And in 1933, he was awarded the Public Welfare Medal from the National Academy of Sciences. And lastly, this relates actually back to one of his books. His book, The World Was My Garden, won a National Book Award as the bookseller discovery in 1938. And they voted at this because they found it to be the most deserving book that kind of failed to receive adequate sales and recognition that it should have. David Fairchild died at the age of 85 on August 6 in 1954 in Florida. He was actually just simply out on a walk with his wife when he collapsed and later died, and it was simply from old age. And lastly, I want to talk about how he's remembered today. We don't want to end with how he died. So his family's home, the Kampong, is now part of the National Tropical Botanical Garden, so you can actually visit it. You can make a reservation. They're free. It's open Tuesday through Friday, so if you are in the Florida area and you love botanical things like I do, it is a great place to visit. Many of the plants that he collected throughout his life, he planted on the Kampong, and they still grow there. They've been meticulously taken care of, and so you can see a lot of rare tropical trees, plants, and different fruits. Sounds like an incredible place to visit for those that are interested. He's also the namesake of David Fairchild Elementary School in South Miami, and he had the scientific name of a species of lizard named after him. The lizard's name is Aenolis fairchildi. And of course, I feel like he could be remembered when we are eating our food, knowing that a lot of the dishes that we enjoy in some part relate back to this man, David Fairchild, who traveled around the world in search of different foods to bring back to America, to introduce them to farmers, and to help stimulate the economy, help with our nutrition. So grateful that there were people like this who were thinking about this in the first place, and then acted on this and have changed what is found in our grocery stores. Thank you guys so much for listening and for joining with me in learning more about David Fairchild, this American botanist. I really enjoyed researching about him, and I hope that you guys enjoyed listening and learning more about him. And now you can go bug people with this knowledge that you now have about our food. I'm definitely going to go let my husband know the history of how the mango got here. I'm sure he'll be so delighted to know all of this. But thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you'll join me next week on the next episode of Plant School. Thank you for being here and listening today, and I hope you'll join me next week. If you'd like to support this podcast and keep it going, you can find the support link below in the description and donate. Or I have some awesome Plant School merch, including stickers, shirts, and mugs, and the link to my shop is in the description as well. And if you don't want to spend any money but still support the podcast, share this podcast with a friend, either verbally or electronically. This will even qualify you for my giveaway. Just message me on Instagram at tinnyplant that you shared the podcast with a friend, and you'll be entered in for a chance to win some goodies. Winners will be announced on the podcast. Again, thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week.